afternoon. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Source News on 4EB Global Digital with Connie Savage and Tyler Salzleschner. In the headlines today, concerns are raised on the neglect and abuse of the elderly in both aged care facilities and in the home with the pending Royal Commission investigation. Far North Queenslanders are losing patience as they've been forced to boil or buy bottled water, with speculation it could be 2 years until the problem is fixed. And the Uniting Church of Australia will be the first Christian denomination to offer same-sex marriage ceremonies from this Friday.
Australian farmers are dumping produce following the strawberry contamination scare, shaking the nation. Increased reports of people finding pieces of metal inside the fruit has led to farmers burning crops and halting exports. Farmers say it's simply cheaper to destroy them than to pick them without knowing how much they can sell. Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk has pledged $1 million to assist the state's strawberry farmers. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says bullying is not a problem in the Liberal Party, despite the pending exit of MP and Sudmalese. Ms. Sudmalese has announced she will not recontest her seat of Gilmore in New South Wales because of alleged intimidation and threats made to her from within the party. The top Chinese military officer has assured Australia of free navigation of the South China Sea amongst heightening tensions between the two countries. Colonel Wang Jing-o says that freedom in the region has never been a problem, and that's up to Australia to challenge China's claim on the region. In a dramatic illustration of Queensland's water woes, locals in the far north of the state have to boil their water to make it drinkable. Residents are furious as they could face a wait of 2 years for a solution. The Tablelands Regional Council issued boil water notices to residents in February after heavy rain in Ravenshoe, but new Queensland health guidelines mean regulators still aren't satisfied the water's fit to drink. Ben Harden has the story.
Ravenshoe is a rural town 2 hours southwest of Cairns and is well known as the highest town in Queensland. However, the town is facing a serious water problem. The community of Ravenshoe has had to boil their drinking water for over 6 months since the notices were issued following heavy rain in February, which resulted in increased turbidity. Turbidity levels have returned to acceptable levels, however, new Queensland health guidelines means regulators still aren't satisfied the water's fit to drink. Mayor Joe Parrinella of the Atherton Tablelands is in Canberra speaking with federal ministers regarding the boil water notices and says his council working to lift the bans.
The problem with it is at the moment is that the water that we have in our area is, in my opinion, and this is my opinion, personal opinion, is most probably the same quality that it has been for many, many years. We did our normal testing, we went through the health department as we normally do, and they said, no, you now have to meet this criteria. I'm actually in Canberra now meeting with ministers, and next month I'll be in Brisbane meeting with ministers down there to see about getting extra funding, see what we can do, because it's a critical problem for the Tableland water infrastructure that we have. And the water infrastructure that we have is almost 500 kilometres, it said 15 water intake.
Nicola is a resident of Ravenshoe and she is fed up and angry that her water, her and her family have been drinking for years, is on notice due to the new guidelines given by Queensland Health recently.
Boil notices are just ridiculous for my family and I. I have 3 children and they are not allowed to drink out of the water bubbles at school. So we have to fill their water bottles and send them to school with them at the request of the school because of the requirements of Queensland Health. It is frightfully inconvenient in this day and age that I should have to boil water for my school children to drink at school.
Do you believe the council should subsidise the amount they charge the locals in affected areas where water is still on boil water notices?
Absolutely, we should be compensated for this. I have another house in Cairns. I'm paying more rates in Ravenshoe than I'm paying in Cairns for much less services, including the basic necessity of life, and that is drinking water that comes out of the tap. We don't live in a third world country. We live in far north Queensland, and drinking water out of a tap seems to be the most basic of needs.
Nicola, have you also seen a change in tourism in the town since the boil notices were given? I know Ravenshoe is well known for its grey nomads coming and visiting the town. Have you seen a change at all?
I can't say that I've seen a change, but I did notice this morning a tourist was coming through and bought a slab of water bottles to take with them because they were too scared to drink the water out of the tap. So, you know, you're making it more expensive for people to come to us if they're going to have to be forced to either boil their water or buy it from the shop when it should be coming out of the tap. They don't understand that this is purely a bureaucratic issue.
With tourist season coming up in North Queensland, businesses are suffering. The Ravenso Highland Bakery said residents and businesses had had to boil their water for over 6 months and that the frustrations were peaking.
Just negativity from the tourists, basically, saying they weren't going to hang around if they had to boil water, saying, you know, what century are we living in?
And you have to boil your water. A lot of water goes into a lot of food these days.
Yeah, that's right. We've got some filter systems installed. But the caravan park people did say that their numbers were down this year compared to normal. So we're in the middle of the season now, or getting towards the end, I suppose. But yeah, it's been quieter than normal, according to the caravan park people and that.
Queensland Health has been contacted for a comment. The local council is holding a meeting for residents affected by the boil water notices on the 2nd of October at 6 p.m. in the town hall.
Thanks, Ben Hutton, for that story.
In the wake of revelations on ABC's Four Corners program this week, concerns have been raised for the safety of elderly people in aged care facilities. The program investigated the quality of residents' lives in several nursing homes and the pressures caused by the understaffing of nursing homes. Patients were fed meals that were allegedly worse than dog food, whilst dementia and Alzheimer's patients were not showered because they did not ask to be. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has announced a royal commission into the matter. Charlie Young, Elder Abuse Director at Bennett and Phillips Lawyers, told our reporter Lauren Martin the commission will discover the extent of problems in the aged care sector.
Nursing homes have a number of minimum standards which they're required to comply with as to how they care for the elderly and the level of training that their staff has, but it is an area which certainly needs improvement, and this is one of the reasons why we're seeing so many problems where people are not being properly cared for in nursing homes.
What are the current laws regarding safety of elders in nursing homes?
The common situations that we're seeing here at Bennett and Philp are situations where the elderly are being neglected in these aged care facilities. They're quite often isolated from other people. They're left to lie in a room and basically stay out of the staff's way. The instances that we see, prisoners get treated a hell of a lot better than the elderly in some of these places.
So what are the requirements for staff? Is there licensing requirements? Anything set in law?
It depends what state we're talking about. In Victoria, I believe there are minimum staff to residence ratios, but I believe in most states of Australia there are no particular requirements as to the number of staff that are within the facilities, and that's often where the problem arises, because the facilities simply don't have enough people to properly care for the residents.
Is that an issue with state funding, or is it something more internal through the nursing home?
I believe it's probably a bit of both, in that the aged care facilities will always argue that they require more funding, but the politicians will always say that they're providing adequate funding. I think one of the main problems is that a lot of these aged care facilities are private enterprises who are most worried about the bottom line and will cut costs where necessary in order to improve profits, and that's having a detrimental impact on their residents.
What are the major issues you see?
The main problems we see are residents being neglected, not being provided nutritious food, being isolated from family members or other residents. These instances aren't at the exploding levels of elder abuse cases we see within the family home.
What level of elder abuse do you see within a home?
That can range from financial abuse, where the elderly person's assets or money's being taken by a relative or an attorney. It could be physical abuse. There could be psychological abuse. There could be neglect is another form of abuse, where the elderly person simply isn't cared for properly. The types of elder abuse are far and wide, and unfortunately they are increasing in prevalence.
That was Lauren Martin reporting. The implementation of the new My Health Record system is putting victims of domestic violence at risk, according to a submission to the Senate Community Affairs Reference Committee. Jake Keenan reports.
Women's Legal Services Queensland has detailed grave safety concerns regarding the new My Health record that will make it easier for domestic violence perpetrators to locate victims in hiding. The new system provides a health record for you to access online, which includes details and locations of all appointments. Women's Legal Services Queensland CEO Angela Lynch is concerned about a loophole that could allow perpetrators to create an account on behalf of their child that is in custody of the victim.
What we understand from the My Health record system is that parents, independent of each other, are able to open up accounts for their children. And what this means for women in domestic violence situations is that perpetrators of violence could track their location through their children's records. So it is there's quite a high level of risk for many women who are in hiding, and also for women who stop or limit the level of control that perpetrators have in their lives.
The My Health record offers an opt-out approach which allows you the option to not receive an online record. However, these measures are still not effective in protecting victims of domestic violence.
The opt-out process is really reliant on people taking some kind of action themselves. And if you are a victim of violence, if you plead violence, you're dealing with a level of trauma, dealing with a level of disruption in your life that may not have the, I suppose, fortitude to go to your doctor to opt out of the My Health record. I don't think the communication campaign from the government has been really effective, and I actually don't think that many people actually know about what their options actually are or understand the implications of this new My Health records process.
Women's Legal Services Queensland are suggesting a new opt-in approach that protects the identity of the victims of domestic violence.
So at this stage, we're unsure about what the government is going to do. We've called for basically a moratorium on the rollout until safety of victims of violence can be guaranteed under this new system. And basically, we're really asking for a system based on informed consent, so that if people want to opt into the system, they're able to, but from an informed consent approach.
Women's Legal Services Queensland is waiting to hear what the recommendations are from the Senate committee.
Intellectually disabled people are reaching out to different organisations so that they can receive the assistance they need to live independently. Lauren Martin reports.
People with disability who are struggling with financial support through the National Disability Insurance Scheme are speaking up, hoping to receive the assistance they need for day-to-day life. Donna Best, a founding member of support group Hot Topics, is concerned the people who don't currently receive financial support will slip through the cracks.
People with intellectual disability who are in the system, the NDIS is fine. For the ones that are not in the system, it's hell.
Miss Best and Hot Topics help disabled people gather the information they need to get support so they can live a more fulfilling life.
We all bring a plate of food along. We have interesting talkers. We've had Sharon McManus come and talk about what she does at QDN, and we've had a lady talk about relationships. I have a mild intellectual disability. They don't know how I got my disability. They think it might have been when I was little that I took convulsions because of tonsillitis.
4 years ago, Louisa Reed underwent surgery for 2 brain aneurysms, during which she had a stroke. She is thankful the doctors were able to quickly reduce the impact of it, but still feels it's had a negative effect on parts of her life. However, Miss Reed is overcoming the struggles and starting a new path in life at the age of 61.
I'd had two articles printed. One was in the Synapse magazine Bridge, and the other one was done in the Brain Foundation magazine, Brain News, I think it was, Brain Waves. Since then, now I'm doing a BA through OUA, which is the Open University Australia, online, and I'm now doing it through Griffith, and I can have support that I need from either OUA or Griffith.
Following her bachelor degree, she will continue postgraduate studies. She wants to receive the National Disability Insurance Scheme, but isn't able to access easy information or support from advocacy groups.
DSP is my income, that's about all it is. I get half from Australia and half from New Zealand.
it's a lot less than I used to earn. It's more than like two-thirds less than what I used to earn. NDIS, I started going to some meetings about NDIS at least 2 years ago. This is the one that I just went to, the fourth one, and I still can't understand what they will do for me.
Kirsten Dean from Make Every Australian Count says a lot of positives are coming out of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, but there are still some shortcomings.
And so it provides things like equipment, like wheelchairs, it provides and hearing aids, it provides support for people to personal care, and it also provides support for people to get out into the community and do the things they want to do. It's a new scheme, it's a new national scheme, it's only been introduced since 2013.
A bag of human bones found at Brisbane's Kangaroo Point last week had been identified as missing woman Constance Watcho. The search for the perpetrator continues. Nathan Ryan specialises in forensic investigative interviewing at the Griffith Institute of Criminology. Although not directly involved in this case, Mr. Ryan tells a reporter, Connie Savage, that this is a rare situation where the body's remains are obviously moved.
It's a strange case because someone has obviously strategically placed the bones in a bag at Kangaroo Point. I don't know whether that's a case of them putting the bones in there after she's decomposed or whether they actually put her in the bag to begin with and she's decomposed in the bag. That's something the forensic experts would know by testing the interior of the bag. So I'm not sure what's happened there, but it's definitely an interesting case, and I think there's a lot of things that'll unfold. Likelihood of catching someone, I think, wouldn't be overly high. Clearance rates for homicides tend to dissipate to nothing after a month or so, and it's been almost a year since they've even deemed it a murder. I think the probability of finding someone is probably quite lower than most other homicide cases.
Is the way in which the bones were placed and discovered something that you think happens quite often?
No, I wouldn't think it's quite often. Homicide itself is a rare crime compared to other sorts of crimes, and the majority of homicides actually solve themselves. So in a case where someone's actually moved the body or tried to hide it, it's a rare situation.
In saying the moving of the body, why do you think her remains were left in a bag in an area that's so utilised and so popular? Do you think whoever committed this act wanted them to be found?
That's a possibility. The fact that they've been placed inside a bag indicates that there's some human action involved in her death. I'm not sure why they would be left in such a public place, but it's quite possible that they wanted them to be found, or they just weren't thinking straight when they did it.
Based on your experience and your knowledge, what do you think could have happened to the woman identified between when she went missing in late November last year, between just a couple of weeks ago when her remains were found?
Could be a lot of different things. Since they've only found a bag of her bones, means that she's been deceased for quite a long while. It's anyone's guess, really, what has happened to her.
In saying that, a detective has said that four people, including the woman identified, have gone missing in the same area in the last 12 months. Do you think these disappearances could be connected in any way?
It's a possibility. There's sort of a large homeless population at Kangaroo Point, so I think depending on the circumstances of those people that went missing, if it's suspicious, and it could possibly be linked. But there's a long way before they could sort of draw those things together.
There is roughly 5 kilometres between where this woman was last seen and where her remains were found. Does this information mean anything to you at all?
If someone is going to hide a missing body, they will tend to hide it close to where the murder has happened. For practical reasons, as you've got to move someone. So they're usually within a few kilometres of where the crime's been committed, and usually within a few kilometres of where the person lives. So it means that the person they're looking for is probably in that area or the region of Kangaroo Point or surrounding areas.
Where this woman did go missing in Greenslopes is actually where she lived as well. So forensic officers are now searching the identified woman's property for evidence. Why do you think they are doing this?
Most homicides, the victim knows the perpetrator, so they'd be looking for clues of people around her that might have a motive to kill her. They'd be gathering any sort of evidence, any sort of DNA evidence to link people to her disappearance or her death.
Police are appealing for information as the investigation continues.
The Uniting Church of Australia will be the first of the 3 major Australian Christian denominations to allow same-sex marriage and offer a church ceremony from this Friday. The move comes 9 months after same-sex marriage was made legal in Australia, and as a result of a decision made at the church's National Assembly in July this year. Our reporters Tyler Selzleschner and Lauren Martin spoke earlier to Q News magazine editor Michael James, who says the church's change of heart is momentous and very significant for people in the LGBTIQ community.
I think it'll be embraced very positively. You have kind of two sides to the community when it comes to religion and sexuality. Well, you have many people within the community do feel quite ostracized from religion, and they do feel quite excluded from it, particularly with things like not being able to marry in the church. And then you also have, on the other side, you have people who are queer and they are religious as well, and they try to, I suppose, reconcile those two things together with the beliefs that are held by the church, and also connecting those beliefs with other people in our community. So those two things, you know, sides are quite separate from each other, and I think having a progressive moment like this is quite a bridging moment for the community, where those who have distanced themselves from the church might actually see that, well, there is actually hope for sexuality in the church to exist together. And conversely, those who are queer and of faith are going to feel more connected to their faith.
In light of this decision by the Uniting Church to grant same-sex marriage, do you think we will see more churches follow suit?
I think it's inevitable. You may have some churches that probably never will, but you know, we're a progressive society, and there is lots of progressive movements within all of the churches of people that are queer and of faith that we know are actively trying to lobby for change within their church, and they actively want to see things change, and they want to be recognised, and they have a strong understanding of how their religious beliefs and their faith and their sexuality align. And I think that it will be inevitable that will happen at some point for most of the churches.
And when you started with Pride, is this the sort of outcome you were looking when we could have churches coming to the party?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I've been with the Pride Festival for 7 or 8 years now. And our goal has always been about continued inclusion and acceptance for our community across the board. And that goes from workplaces through to educational facilities through to churches as well. We want to see those changes, and we're always actively lobbying for people to be included in all different ways, shapes and forms, and churches included. So, you know, it wasn't 100% on our radar that was, you know, where we were specifically going, was being able to get married in churches, but it was certainly within the realms of things that we definitely wanted.
Quick personal question for you. When you were growing up, when you realised your sexual orientation, how did the community accept you? Were they accepting, or were they a bit hesitant toward you?
For me, I mean, I didn't have a religious community growing up, thankfully. I'm a very non-religious person, a very non-religious household, which is great. But conversely, I also was in a very accepting small community that I grew up in. So it was really quite a good experience for me. My school community was small. I had lots of supportive friends and teachers, and my family were all very supportive as well. So I'm one of the very lucky few. And as society progresses now, more and more people are growing up with that kind of experience that I had, where sexuality is becoming such a nonchalant issue. It's no longer even a struggle for some queer kids at the moment to come out. I'm teaching back at my own high school at the moment, and they have a Pride support group here that meets every Friday that's got 25 to 30 members in it. So, you know, that's the kind of great environment I got to grow up with and be accepted in, and that's continuing into the future for our next generation.
Michael, can you tell me about your relationship? I understand you're in a long-term relationship.
Yes, that's right. So I've been with my partner for 14, almost 15 years now. And we have a son together who we adopted about 8 or 9 years ago. And we got engaged about 8 or 9 years ago as well. And we're planning to get married sometime in the near future. And I'm devout atheist. My partner has his own religious beliefs. His beliefs fall within the spectrum of the Catholic Church, and where he associates himself with religiously, but he doesn't go to church. We don't plan to marry in a church either. Well, not in a religious sense, in a church anyway. We are just, for us, marriage is our thing, and that's how we're going to make it, and we don't need to do it in the church. It's not about the institution. For us, marriage is about a commitment to each other in front of our friends and family, irrespective of God or otherwise.
That was Tyler Selzleschner and Lauren Martin reporting. Belangala Community Centre celebrates its 10th anniversary this year with talks by Indigenous elders from across Brisbane.
In the Brisbane suburb of The Gap, local people gathered on Sunday to hear talks from Indigenous elders and community leaders. Hosted by Bolangala Community Centre and its volunteers, the events kicked off a series of celebration of Indigenous culture. These leaders, including former Indigenous Queenslander of the Year Bob Wetherill, spoke for 2 hours about issues for disadvantaged Australians. Ms. Wetherill says his people deserve the best choice to succeed in the future.
Until it sinks in to museums, universities, medical schools, developers, government and whoever else that has power, that holds all the power in their hands, they are the ones that we are denying or depriving Aboriginal peoples.
Bolangala hosts events for all ages every second Sunday until the end of the year. Chairman Morris Salico first started Bolangala in 2008 as a response to the Australian government's sorry message.
People just look at him and see this lovely old man, but when they hear his achievements, they flabbergasted by what a person with an amount of drive is able to achieve.
Bolangala is open to the public from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. every day and accepts any volunteer applications before October the 30th.
Thanks to Stella Chen for that report.
And to sports, in NRL, overshadowing this weekend's semi-final clash with the Sydney Roosters is confirmation that the South Sydney Rabbitohs have set up a 5-person committee to investigate sexting complaints made against several players. It's been confirmed that husband, father and Rabbits forward, Sam Burgess, owns a social media account from which inappropriate, unsolicited videos were shared. Burgess declined to comment and South Sydney management refused to confirm the names of players involved in the scandal. The alleged exchange occurred in May 9th, 2016, and the recipient of the video lodged a formal complaint in June of the same year. To AFL now, the North Adelaide AFL team has been fined $10,000 and docked 4 premiership points for allowing an extra player on the field for a brief period against the Woodville West Torrens. The SA NFL Tribunal Chair, Michael David QC, says North Adelaide were grossly negligent for having 19 players on the field during the 14th quarter of Sunday's game. Despite the Tribunal's findings, North Adelaide will be allowed to play in an SA NFL Grand Final against North Norwood at the Adelaide Oval on Sunday. To weather, a top of 21 degrees this evening with an overnight low of 14, mostly sunny throughout the rest of the week with a slight chance of showers and light winds expected. It's currently 20 degrees in Brisbane. And that's today's top stories on Source News. Thanks for listening.